Lecture 17, The March to the Sea.
Welcome back. King Artaxerxes of Persia had not been willing to believe that his younger brother Cyrus would ever make it as far as Babylonia with an army. And so he'd been very slow to collect an army of his own. And when that messenger came over the horizon telling Prince Cyrus that his brother Artaxerxes was approaching, it was with an army that Artaxerxes still did not feel was ready to meet his brother. And the reason Artaxerxes was so worried was because of those Greeks, those 10,000 hoplites. He had nothing to put up against his brother's force that was equally fearsome, equally respected as an armed force. And we have to remember that for all these people out on this field, their last memory of an actual pitched battle between Greeks and Persians was all the way back 65 years earlier at the Eurymedon River, when Cimon the Athenian stormed ashore from his victorious fleet, brought his troops to land, and attacked the Persian position there. There had not been a pitched battle, even Marathon early on, where the Persians had managed to prevail over Greek hoplites. So it was with terror that Artaxerxes had learned that his brother had managed to put together this 10,000-strong force of hoplites and bring them down into the heart of the kingdom. Nevertheless, they had arrived in Babylonia long before they were expected. Artaxerxes took the troops he had. It's been estimated he probably had 40 or 45,000, and he brought them north to meet his brother. They met on a vast plain near the city of Babylon and near a village called Cunaxa. And Cunaxa has given its name to the battle that took place on that plain. The horsemen arrived at a very awkward moment of the day for Prince Cyrus and his men. It was so early in the day that it was clear that the battle would probably happen before nightfall. It was late enough in the day that the men had not had their dinner, their all-important midday meal, and there was no time to prepare it. In fact, the 30,000 or so troops of Cyrus were spread out in a long, casual marching order, and it was all that they could do to get the troops together, form their lines, and be prepared to meet Artaxerxes with the united front when he finally appeared over the edge of the plain ahead of them. This was the battle order that Cyrus decided upon. He would be in the center with his prime Persian cavalry. To his left would be a faithful Persian noble loyal to his cause named Arieus, with all of the Asiatic troops, who are mainly light-armed, mobile troops with lances, small spears, and javelins. To the right are the Greeks, 10,000 strong, four deep. Normal hoplite phalanxes marched eight deep, if you can imagine that, eight ranks, so that the front rank is jammed up against the enemy and the rear rank are ready to come forward, walking over the dead bodies of their comrades if necessary to take their place in trying to mow down the enemy. Why did they do only half the normal depth? Why was it four deep? Because Cyrus wanted his front line long. He knew he was outnumbered by his brother. It's a terrible thing for an ancient army or any army to be outflanked. And he wanted to get the Greeks all the way from the edge of the Persian cavalry formation all the way to the Euphrates River. And that way the river could be the barrier on his right wing that would prevent Artaxerxes' forces from getting around. Over the edge of the horizon came Artaxerxes. The Greeks were very dismayed, as Xenophon remembers. They had told themselves that they would be facing an undisciplined horde. Nothing could be further from the truth. They had expected barbaric war cries and yelling of savages trying to keep their spirits up. Artaxerxes' army came forward in dead silence. He had arrayed his troops in a very similar way to Cyrus. His center was also his cavalry, and he himself was facing his brother across the plain, center to center. On the Persian right, which was facing Arieus and the left wing of Prince Cyrus, there was a mass of Asiatic troops, and on the Persian left, King Artaxerxes' left, there was the satrap Tissaphernes, brought all the way back from Lydia, from Sardis, to command the best forces that Artaxerxes could find, except for his own household cavalry, in an attempt to deal with the Greeks. There were Egyptian foot soldiers. There were men from all over the empire. And in front of them, something that the Greeks had never seen, chariots to which scythes that were normally used out in the field to harvest the wheat, they had been attached to the axles of the chariots. And as the wheels spun, so these long scythe blades spun also, extending out on either side of the chariot. There were more blades below the chariot body, so that any Greek unlucky enough to fall down and have a chariot pass over would be sliced up by these wicked blades. The demoralizing effect was probably greater even than the strategic effect would have been, but the Greeks were certainly shocked to see this much preparation, this much serious thought going into how do you deal with a hoplite phalanx. And, of course, with the hoplite phalanx, cohesion is all. If a scythe chariot can charge its way through and break open a gap in the phalanx, all is lost. Prince Cyrus left his station in the middle and paraded down the front of his army, talking to the men, cheering them on, encouraging them. Young Xenophon remembers stepping out of the ranks and having a word with the king, Cyrus, as Cyrus went by. And Cyrus reached Clearchus, the general, and called him forward. And he said, I've now seen my brother's disposition of troops. We need to change our plan. I want you to shift so that you move into the center and you tackle the cavalry. I don't want you facing these scythe chariots, and I don't want you facing an inessential part of my brother's army. I want you hitting my brother himself. Clearchus said to Cyrus, and I want you out of the battle. We're fighting for you. What's the profit to us if we win a battle and you, our leader, have died in the course of it? Cyrus said, I cannot back down. This is a duel between myself and my brother. I would lose all honor if I stayed behind and sent my men forward to do the dirty work for me. But, said Cyrus, you will move to the center. And Clearchus gave him an ambiguous answer, saying, I will deal with it. Now, Clearchus had no intention of obeying Cyrus's order. His right wing was up against the Euphrates River, and that meant it was protected. Hoplite phalanxes have a curiosity, an eccentricity. They are terrified for what will happen on their right wing. Remember, every man's got a shield on his left arm. That means every man is protected by the shield of the man to his right, except the soldier on the far right of the position. Here they were in a dream position, the banks of the Euphrates River, which could not be traversed by Tissaphernes' troops, were next to that right-hand man in each of the four ranks. If they move away, as Cyrus had commanded, into the middle of the battlefield, those right men are exposed and they have no armor on their right hands. That simple strategic concern caused Clearchus to tell his men, keep your position. And that decision probably lost the battle for Cyrus. Because as they joined battle, as the trumpet sounded, as at last the war cries were let loose, and they surged forward, a remarkable thing happened. The Greeks, moving forward at the quick march, saw the enemy melt away in front of them. It seemed like the dream come true. We won't have to fight a battle after all. And they were drawn further and further back beyond the main army of Artaxerxes as they pursued this unresisting left wing of the enemy formation, with Tissaphernes leading his troops, and he is mounted himself. He's on a little detachment of horses, of cavalry. They are falling back, and the Greeks are following them, rejoicing in the fact that their enemy seemed to be giving up. Meanwhile, Cyrus has charged straight at the center, having realized that the Greeks were not going to do anything. By the way, I forgot to mention those scythed chariots. They proved to be no use at all. Remember, they hadn't been used before. The horses became very unruly. The charioteers turned the horses back around toward the rear and tried to retreat with them. A few of the horses were so hard to handle, they threw the charioteers from the chariots, and then those were the ones that turned around and charged at the Greeks. The phalanx found all it had to do was open its ranks, let the Scythe chariot run through, and then close up again after it. Only one man was foolish enough to get in the path, and he was run over. So that wasn't a very serious outcome from the Scythe chariots, and the Greeks, full of conviction that they were winning this battle, and certainly they were on the right wing, they pushed onward, southward. Cyrus fought his way through and hit his brother's cavalry with such force that he broke it up. And he was able to penetrate, but like the Greeks, he made the mistake of pursuing an early advantage too impetuously. He forged his way right into the heart of this melee of horsemen, trying to get at his brother, whom he hated with a passion. And there was this dream that he would be the one to cut his brother down. He managed to get close. He actually managed to throw a javelin or thrust in with a javelin and wound his brother in the chest. And Artaxerxes was then taken by his doctor, a Greek medic named Ctesias of the city of Cnidos, who was sort of a descendant of that Greek doctor Democedes of Sicily, who was King Darius's trusted doctor before the Ionian Revolt and was sent by Darius to do a scouting mission of the Greek world. Here we have another Greek in place. He goes with Artaxerxes and his companions to a hilltop. He dresses Artaxerxes' wounds. He ultimately wrote another account of the battle, which provides an alternative view to Xenophon's, although since it's mainly lost, we only have fragments and references to go on. At any rate, Artaxerxes has now been pulled out of the fight, and Cyrus, Prince Cyrus, finds that he has forged ahead too far. And he has left the main body of his own cavalry behind, and he is surrounded by his brother's supporters. They get him off his horse, and they kill him on the ground. And that's the end of Cyrus. Well, that should have been the end of the battle, except how do you let people know the battle is over? It's very difficult in the ancient world, and in fact, the right wing, the Greeks, never learned that Cyrus had been killed. There were counterattacks from Tissaphernes. They finally did have a battle on their hands. They were surrounded at one point by people who outflanked them. And they finally saw a hill in the distance covered with Persian cavalry, and they marched up to that hill, and the enemy melted away in front of them. So they sent some of their forces up on the hill. They ultimately all went up on the hill, looked out on this vast plain filled with clouds of dust, a melee of shifting forces of cavalry, chariots, foot soldiers. They just couldn't see what was going on. And they were puzzled that they had received no messenger from Cyrus, their prince, about how he had fared at the battle. The sun was going down. The battle was over. Cunaxa had ended. The Greeks felt it had surely ended in a great victory. And they had nowhere to go, so they spent the night hungry, without their dinners, without their suppers, tired, but scarcely having lost a man. The 10,000 settled down on that hill and waited for morning. With morning came the terrible news. They might have won their half of the battle, but Cyrus had been killed. Without a leader, what were they? They were the strangest thing that anyone in the ancient world had ever experienced, a hostile city of armed men plunked down in the middle of a great empire that didn't know what to do with them. Artaxerxes found them a tremendous embarrassment. He couldn't pay them. He couldn't take them into Persian service. He wasn't sure he could defeat them if he actually confronted them. What was he going to do? So some negotiations were opened. He asked them to surrender, thinking, well, at least that's a start, and they refused. Finally, Tissaphernes, that wily satrap who had dealt with the Greeks all along, offered to be the go-between. And he went to Clearchus and the other leaders of the Greeks, and he said, the king will provide you with provisions if you will agree to leave his realm. And all they wanted to do was get home. They could have, in fact, probably gotten to the edge of Persian territory somewhere and established a Greek city there. But that held no attraction to them. These were men who had left their homes seeking their fortunes. They had hoped to make themselves rich in this war, and they wanted to get back, each to his own city. So they accepted this offer, and Tissaphernes rounded up a baggage train and said, you can't get home by the way you came here. And he had several reasons for saying this, one of which was that that way led back to his satrapy. And the last thing he wanted to do was have the 10,000 at large loose on the plains of Lydia and causing trouble for him. But he had a larger plan in mind. He is intending to lead them into mountainous territory where they will become lost. And he hopes they'll either starve to death or have to surrender in small groups. But at any rate, they will never again pose a threat to him or to any other Persian. They don't know what to do. They have no geographers or map makers among them. Their baggage train has been looted. That was the great loss. They are now without most of their own supplies and equipment and camp followers. And so, with the remnant of the baggage train, they agree they will go north following Tissaphernes. So they pass northward through the plains of Babylonia. Then this time they cross not the Euphrates to get home, but the Tigris. And they get to the other side, and now the mountains are starting to rise up ahead of them. And Tissaphernes tells them that is their destination. They will go into the hills, and he will take them up through Armenia and to the Black Sea. That, he says, is the nearest body of water for them, which actually was true. We must never forget that their morale was incredibly low. Because they had allowed Cyrus to trick them stage by stage, luring them deeper and deeper into Persia, by the time of Cunaxa, they found themselves exactly where no Greek ever wanted to be, 1,500 miles from the seacoast of Asia Minor. Remember back to the beginnings of our story, the year 499 BC, when Aristagoras of Miletus brought his map to Sparta and showed the Spartans the way into Persia from Sardis and Lydia, and explained that it's a three-month journey in, and that was enough to make the king of Sparta, back in 499, say, "Get out! I will not talk to anyone who wants to take the Spartans that far from the sea." Most of the 10,000 felt the same way. They were appalled at what had happened to them. They just wanted to get home as quickly as possible. And like most men in that kind of situation, they weren't always thinking as clearly as they should have. They now are in the heart of what we might call the Middle East. To the south of them is Babylonia. To the southeast is Persia itself, the great Iranian plateau and the city of Susa. Off to the east, in the way of the rising sun, is the Central Asiatic Plateau, completely unknown and impassable to them. On to the north are the mountains. Off to the southwest, they would come down into Syria and ultimately the eastern Mediterranean, the coast of the Levant and the Phoenician cities. And finally, to their west is that land that they traversed initially, the great block of land that we call Anatolia or Asia Minor, modern Turkey, the one way that they've decided they won't go back. So northward seems the only possibility, and they follow Tissaphernes stage by stage into these hills. They cross a branch of the Tigris again, and they are now surrounded by the Cardukian Mountains, real wild territory. They are, in fact, out of Persian territory. There was a wedge of wild mountainous country that the great king had never managed to conquer, even he. And the wild tribes there were very much a law unto themselves. Tissaphernes was hoping that this would be the killing ground where the 10,000 would finally be eaten up by the rigors of an Asiatic winter, by the mountains, they're getting lost on the trails, and by the hill tribes doing the work for him. A little fight broke out, probably instigated by Tissaphernes, between some Persians and some Greeks. Clearchus, the Greek general, went to Tissaphernes and demanded an explanation. And Tissaphernes said, "I want to work this out with you. Please come to my tent." He had a great field pavilion, like the one Xerxes had had during the Salamis campaign. And he said, "Come to my tent, bring your colleagues with you." So Clearchus, truly not thinking clearly, got together all four of the other generals of the 10,000, including that Proxenus of Boeotia, who had been the friend of Xenophon, who recruited that young man to the cause. And they brought with them about 20 of their subordinate officers and a whole lot of attendants. Well, what was Clearchus thinking? "I shall make a grand show. I shall show this Persian satrap, Tissaphernes, who is really the powerful one here." But this show was his undoing. They got into the tent. Only the five were admitted. They are by a river whose name would live in infamy in Greek memory, the river Zab, the greater Zab. And as they got in the tent, they were seized, these five generals, and bound as prisoners. They, in fact, lived for a considerable length of time. Tissaphernes took them back into Babylonia, and they were executed there for the pleasure of King Artaxerxes. But the 20 outside, the subsidiary officers, equally important for the cohesion and command of the 10,000 troops, they were cut down to a man. They were all killed where they stood, and then the Persians mounted their horses and rode out among the attendants who were milling here and there on the flat area in front of the pavilion, and with no warning and working silently, killed them one after the other with their lances. One man got away. He'd been cut across the belly, one of these Greeks, and managed to get on his horse and get back to the Greek camp, where the Xenophon and the other Greeks had no idea of what was happening, till they saw this man coming, holding his guts into his body and shouting, "Treachery, treachery, the generals have been killed." Immediately, the Greeks grabbed their shields, formed their lines, but Tissaphernes had no intention of fighting them. They were to be left to their own fate. He would dog their steps as they moved through the mountains, but he would never offer them what they truly wanted, a pitched battle. That they knew they could win. This endless harassment, which is what they were now treated to, was something that they weren't sure they could survive. What did they do, these Greeks, 10,000 or so strong in the heart of Asia? They behaved like Greeks. They sat down and they had a town meeting. Everybody had to have their chance to speak. Every idea was put forward. Let's remember old Herodotus and his statement, "It's important that many views be expressed. How else can the best be selected?" And so as each one made proposals and talked, the army finally decided they would elect five new generals. Xenophon, this young Athenian in his 20s, this somewhat bookish scholar of Athens who had been a student of Socrates, he was chosen to be the general at the head of the rear of the army. And there were four others, some more prominent than he, all more prominent than he, ahead of him, right up to the vanguard. They got on the march. They decided, because they didn't know what else to do, to continue northward, as Tissaphernes had initially recommended, and just fight their way through the mountains. It's hard to express how much courage went into this. It was the time that winter was coming on. Down on the plains of Babylonia in what would have been the month of August or September, they had fried in the heat. Now these cold winter winds were starting to blast them. They didn't have adequate clothing. They barely had adequate supplies. The one reason that Tissaphernes had made it easy for himself to lure them there was plenty of fresh water. That was the one thing that they didn't have a problem with. Lots of springs, lots of mountain streams. Otherwise, they were in desperate, desperate shape. But they forged northward, just going by the North Star and their sense of where the trails were leading them. Tissaphernes behind, launching little lightning-like attacks on their rear where Xenophon was, and then the hill tribes appeared. And also, refusing to engage them in a pitched battle, would get on the cliffs above their trails that they were following and roll rocks and avalanches down on them. So many of the men were being killed in this most difficult of all situations for a Greek hoplite. No level field on which to deploy, no space in which to form the phalanx, strung out on these mountain trails. It's a miracle that any of them got through. And they were very demoralized. They continually had meetings, many different ideas, some to go back, some to try to bring Tissaphernes to battle. But onward and onward, northward and northward they went. At last, sometime probably in absolute midwinter, they came to a river and were told by the locals that on the other side was civilization at last, a satrapy of the Persian Empire called Armenia. But there on that other shore, they had so longed to get back to civilization, there was a Persian army. It was the army of the satrap Tiribazos, satrap of Armenia, and he didn't want the 10,000 in his province, and he was there to try to stop them. And he was convinced that simply a show of force along the edge of the mountain torrent would be enough to prevent the Greeks from crossing. Meanwhile, behind them came the hill tribes, now having caught the Greeks, the 10,000s between themselves and the river, they had decided to wipe them out and take all of their armor and enrich themselves with all the things that the Greeks had been carrying. Not even on the battlefield at Kunaxa itself had the 10,000 been in such peril, and they owed their preservation to alertness, a stroke of luck, and their readiness to seize the advantage when they saw it. Two young Greek soldiers, out gathering kindling for their fire, went half a mile along the river and saw locals on the far side near a rocky place behaving in a way that suggested there might be a crossing. The two young Greeks stripped off their clothes, waded in naked except for their daggers, and discovered to their joy that at this point there was a concealed ford across the river, and the water did not even come up to their crotches. So they ran back to the camp, they told Xenophon himself, who shared this information with his colleagues, and they decided upon a plan. Half the army moved along the shore with the baggage train behind them in full battle array. Xenophon with the other half brought up the rear. They went down to that newly discovered crossing place, sang the great battle hymn. Even the camp followers, the women that had shared their ordeals and followed them through thick and thin, sang along with the soldiers. And then they faced into the river several columns abreast and forged down into the stream. The horsemen on the far side came down, but they couldn't get to the opposite side at the crossing place because of the rocks. Meanwhile, Xenophon turned and ran back toward the original crossing place with that rear half of the army. And the horsemen on the other side, fearing that they might be caught in a pincer movement between these two groups of Greeks, fled into the hinterlands. Then Xenophon came back, covered the crossing of the baggage train, and led a charge straight up the slope into the mass of the hillmen who were coming down trying to pick off the Greek rear guard. The leaders of the Greeks sent back the archers and the javelin throwers. They covered Xenophon and his men as they crossed, and in this way, the entire army got to the other side. On the far side of the river, now in Armenia, they encountered deep snows and the Persian satrap of Armenia, Tiribazos. He wanted them out of his province as rapidly as possible. He promised them safe passage if they would, in turn, promise not to plunder his domain. So they agreed, and they forged on through the snow, but it became clear that he was dogging their footsteps with his own troops, and that as soon as they came to a vulnerable place, he intended to strike. By good luck, scouts discovered where Tiribazos' camp was, now very lightly defended since its master was out on the road following the Greeks. And the lightly armed Greek auxiliaries, in a daring dash, crossed over to Tiribazos' camp, captured his supplies, captured his own tent, his bakers, and his silver-footed couch, and now very well supplied, and with great satisfaction, the 10,000 were able to continue their way north, north and north, passing mountain ranges, vast plains, villages, finally to their joy in the springtime. They came to a city, the first one that they had seen in months, a place called Gineas, and the people there said, "You're very close. It's just a matter of days from here up to the Black Sea." So, with hope in their hearts, they forged on northward. And on the fifth day after leaving Gymnias, Xenophon in the back found himself and his rear guard following the rest of the army up this immense slope toward a high pass. They were a mile and a half up. The air was thin. They were at the top of some sort of great mountain massif. And suddenly Xenophon heard, tumbling back down the line of men, the sound of shouting. A sound he had not heard for months. It sounded like battle cries. And as each line got to the crest, they started shouting too. And his great dread was that they were at last facing, in this more open terrain, an army of Persians that had been sent to block their way, and that in fact they were in a trap, and that this pass would be the place where they all met their end. So in an effort to try to find out what was going on, he spurred his own horse up the slope, and as he got into the center part of the army, he could finally hear what the men were shouting, "Thalassa, thalassa," or in the other dialect of Greek, "Thalata, thalata," the sea, the sea. He came up to the brink of the pass, and an extraordinary vision met his sight. There was the Black Sea spread out before them, its beautiful waters, blue in the sunshine. He was surrounded by crusty veterans who were weeping, hugging each other. They had seen that thing that is more dear to Greeks than any other, the sea, that universal mother of all the Greeks. None of their cities were very far from the life-giving sea. They were much more accustomed to go from place to place in their ships than on land. At last they felt, though they were still 1,000 miles from Greece itself, that vision of that water made them feel they were home. So each man took a stone from the surrounding slopes. They piled up a gigantic cairn as a monument to that great moment when the army of the 10,000 finally once again beheld the sea. And it's an exciting thing that that mound was searched for years by archaeologists, by historians. No one could find it. No one was sure where the pass lay until at last, just a few years ago, a team discovered not only the remnants of the cairn, but a most unusual thing, a vast plain up there on that upland mountainous slope with no loose rocks at all. Every single one had been picked up 2,400 years ago and carried into the cairn. So we know exactly where it was now that Xenophon and his comrades beheld the sea. They made their way down the other side. Their adventures were by no means over. They had arrived at the absolute southeast corner of the Black Sea in an area where there are beautiful rhododendron bushes on the slopes. They were all in bloom, and the bees were producing honey. So here it seemed like a gift to the gods. Combs dripping with new honey. The men ate it uncontrollably, not knowing that rhododendron honey is toxic. And the last horror for this army of 10,000 was the writhing, dying men on the ground who were in delirium from this honey that they'd eaten. But that was the last of the terrible trials of their march. They reached Trebizond, as the Byzantines called it, the modern city of Trabzon and the ancient Greek city of Trapezus. And after waiting there for a long time, managed to find ships and begin the final stages of their journey back to Greece. Xenophon arrived in Greece and discovered that he was just too late for what he considered the most tragic event of his time. The Athenians had arrested Socrates, they had tried him, and executed him in the year 399 BC, and it was a grief to Xenophon for the rest of his life that he had not been there to help his master in his hour of need. Xenophon remained in exile from Athens. He settled down in the Peloponnese, a guest of the Spartans. He wrote books on, as I said, horsemanship, but also on hunting, on one of his heroes, King Agesilaus, on the greatest of his heroes, Socrates, a whole book called Memorabilia, which is the conversations of Socrates that Xenophon could remember. But the work that he was best known by was that Anabasis, that going up, that incredible tale of the bravery of the 10,000, all of the extraordinary turns of fortune that they encountered and that they finally overcame. That book became a textbook for the Greeks who wanted to learn about Persia, who wanted to learn about warfare, learn about courage. And above all, it fell into the hands of a young man, several generations after Xenophon, named Alexander the Great. And it was reading Xenophon's book that inspired the young Alexander with the idea, yes, truly, that march can be made.